He was concerned. He was worried about me. I cursed myself for having spoken. I shouldn't have said anything. Not yet, anyway. I should have waited until I was sure that either Xander or Katrin, or both, had seen something. The way he was reacting was the opposite of what I'd hoped, and I could hardly backtrack. "Yes," I said, "I am well. I'm dealing with the after-effects of the battle on Klostrum." I stuck to my determination to be honest. If I said nothing, I could expect to be called to task later. "What I have experienced here is unrelated to that. Yes, I have seen your mother." I felt a reckless pride in making that declaration. I wondered if this was how Xander had felt in the unforgiving light. "A ghost?" Xander gasped, horrified by the blasphemous thought. "I don't know if that's what she is," Xander cut me off. "Father, no!" he cried. "Think about what you're saying." He was shaking. He took 3 deep breaths and tried to speak more calmly. "I didn't want to hear you last night, but you were telling me what I needed to hear. Please, please listen to me now. You must not say these things. You must not think them. They are crimes against the Emperor." He took my hands in his. "For your sake, Father, I beg you." "I know she can't be a ghost," I reassured him. I almost sounded convincing in my ears. "All I'm saying is that I've seen her. I also know that in at least one instance, there is no chance that I was dreaming." "Have you told anyone else about this?"
"Cardinal Rivas."
"Oh, good." Xander radiated relief. "What does the Cardinal have to say?"
"He's concerned about possible danger."
"He believes that you saw Mother?"
"Yes."
That gave him pause.
"Is it so impossible to believe?" I said, beginning to plead. "If you are willing to believe in a curse, a belief which you denounced last night..."
"I did. I still do not believe you're right. I can't. Why keep fighting if we are foredoomed? We must keep fighting. But I should not be a hypocrite. I do not believe you are right. I cannot state you are wrong, especially given what I've seen."
Xander gazed down into his empty mug. When he looked up, his eyes were sad. "I would like to see Mother," he said. "I wish I had. But she's dead, Father. She's been dead a long time. She's gone."
"I don't think you understand," I began. He stood up, interrupting me. "I must be off. I'll see you in council." He thought for a moment. "You haven't spoken to Katrin about this yet?"
"I haven't had the chance, no."
"I wouldn't."
I had no intention of doing so. I had thought Xander would be receptive to the idea. If I was this wrong about him, Katrin might well sever all ties with me.
"I'm sorry, Father, but I have to ask. Is there madness in our family?"
"Is that what you think? Do I seem mad? I don't know what to think. But there's Lionel. And now me."
He glanced over his shoulder, in the direction of the librarium.
"That would be one explanation for our genealogy. That might be our doom."
"I'm lonely. Montfort was right, as far as that goes. I need company. I'm lonely, and I resent it. The problem is, I don't know if I can do anything about it. I don't even know if anyone can help, or if they want to. I'm starting to think that they may be trying to harm me. After today, given what I have seen, I think that might be the case. That would make sense, wouldn't it? I was foolish to think Veth Montfort came here out of the goodness of her heart. I don't think anyone has ever confirmed that she even has one. That doesn't mean her advice was bad. Her reasons for giving it might be foul, but she wasn't wrong. And I've been trying, these last few days, to do as she suggested. I wonder, Mason, what you would think if you read that. What would you think of your wife following the wisdom of Veth Montfort? I wish you did know. You don't, though. You aren't here. I won't say it's like you never were. That isn't true. If you'd never been here, I wouldn't be in Malvale. I wouldn't be digging through the mountains in these rooms, hoping to find information that will mean I don't have to worry about the future of my children. If you'd never been here, I wouldn't be torturing myself about whether I'm doing enough to preserve the governorship of the Strocks. And I doubt very much that I would be receiving inexplicably friendly visits from the senior counselor. You were here. You were here enough to change every facet of my life. I know that not long ago I was grateful for that. I don't remember how I felt then. I don't feel like that at all now. Can you hear me, Mason?
No, you can't.
Will you ever again? I shouldn't let myself think that way, but I can't help it. This is where I am. Now, I'm all alone. Even when the serfs are here, I'm all alone, and I don't think that's a good thing. I've tried, like I said, I've tried not to be alone. It hasn't gone well for a number of reasons. I don't think they're all my fault. Montfort really wanted me to get out of Marvale. At least, that's what she said. She sounded convincing. She must be good at making people believe what she wants them to believe, of course. But what she said seemed sensible. I hadn't been out of the house for several days. I'm not sure how long exactly. I've been having trouble keeping track of the dates since I started to feel ill, and anyway, it's winter, and every day is a cold, windy, wet misery. There aren't any differences that matter between the days. This isn't a very organized entry, is it? Yes, then I went out. Montfort said I should see my friends. That made me think again about how few of them are still left. I shouldn't feel sorry for myself, though, even if I'm finding it that self-pity comes very easily. I still know people. I have acquaintances, so I arranged to meet a few for a meal in the afternoon. I felt a bit guilty. If I was well enough to do this, I should have been well enough to resume my duties at the Administratum. But I couldn't face those. The mental energy of riding herd on the scribes and keeping an iron grip on our tenuous, easily broken forms of order, there is more than I can muster at the moment. I'm reasonably confident that I've delegated things well enough that matters will keep for a bit longer. So I went out. I was about to write that this was 4 days ago, but I think it might have been longer. The more I think about it, the more I'm sure it was, but I don't know how long. Treva Garnheim hosted. She used to work in the Estate Imperium with me many years ago. She married into nobility too, and decided to focus her energies on the advancement of her new house. That is her duty now. The upper levels of Valgar society are the sea in which she swims. We used to be close. We've grown apart. We aren't unfriendly, though, and House Garnheim has always been allied to House Strock. When I got in touch with Treva and she suggested that she host a small gathering, that seemed like just the thing. It required no effort on my part, other than showing up. It was a mistake to go. It felt wrong to leave Marvale. I should have listened to my impulses. I'm not well enough even to walk around the grounds for more than a short while. Going into Valgast did me harm, not good. Treva sent her car for me, and I could barely keep my head up during the ride to Garnheim Manor, on the western edge of the city. I was exhausted by the time we reached our destination. Treva's driver almost had to carry me into the house. I was anxious too, and became more and more nervous as the afternoon wore on. I couldn't concentrate on what anyone was saying. I knew everyone there. I'd been close once to quite a few. On that day, though, it was as if I'd never met them before. No, wait, that isn't quite it. It was as if I never even met them then. As if they weren't really there. Or maybe it was me who wasn't there. They might have been images on a picked screen with which I was simply pretending to interact. And the effort to keep up that pretense was excruciating. By the end of the afternoon, I was so tired. I was having trouble breathing. And the anxiety was developing into terror. I had to get out of there. I had to get back to Marvale. It was a relief when I did get back. I felt better, if not exactly well, immediately. I won't be going out again. Not while I feel like this. While I was at Treva's, I tried to combat the terror by analysing it, hoping I could tramp it down if I could identify its source. It was my project, my history of the Strock governors. I'm always thinking about it. But when I was away from Marvale, it felt like the project was in jeopardy. As if only my presence in Marvale could prevent the entire house from going up in flames. Nonsense, yes. I didn't think that would happen, but I felt as if it would. So that attempt was a disaster. I didn't give up, though. I made one more try at doing what Montfort asked. I hope she'd be pleased. Or I hope Mason would be pleased. Maybe I don't care after all. I acted as though I did. I invited Treva and the others to come and see me in Marvale. I would be less tired that way. I wouldn't be anxious. I hoped I would enjoy their company. I hoped I wouldn't be lonely. The experience was worse than at Garnheim Manor. I was less nervous. I was less tired. I was able to pay attention this time. That's why it was worse. I was able to see the truth of things. Everyone was pleasant. I can remember what we talked about. None of it mattered. I looked at these people whom I thought I knew fairly well. They were hollow. If I'd ever really known them, that was no longer the case. Things were changing. Their bodies were present, but they were only shells. They might as well have been servitors, tasked to perform the motions of a social gathering. I felt that if I stared at Treva and the others long enough, I would see right through their bodies. Their skin would become translucent. Inside was nothing, not even bone. These people had not come to see me. They had come to take their leave. They were abandoning me. Even as they sat there talking, they were abandoning me, hollowing themselves out, turning into pantomiming shadows. I hated them. I could not get rid of them fast enough. I will not be hosting any other events in Marvale. Mason was the first to abandon me, and he has taken everyone in his wake. First the children, then all the others. I am alone. I was on my way to the inner chamber when Vice caught up to me and took me aside. "You're going to have to do without me today," she said. "I think I can fend Montfort off." "I know you can. What will you be doing?" "Gathering ammunition, I hope. I've heard some rumours about Montfort, ones that might be useful to us if there's any truth to them. I'm going to see if there is." "Go where?" "To Silling." "Montfort's home. I didn't like the idea." "She may be here, but she will still have eyes there." "I know. I'm not about to break in. I have a possible informant in the house." "Good luck, then." "I'll meet you at Marvale after council," she said, and headed off back down the hall. The council session was relatively calm. We were all gathering our strength for the storm to come. We were engaged in an administrative charade, performing the actions of government with our thoughts elsewhere. Mine certainly were, and the lack of conflict suggested this was the case for my opponents too. My thoughts careened from one pressure point to another. Every time I looked at Xander, he was watching me with deep concern. I worried about how much damage I'd done that morning. I wondered what Vice might have found, and what she might be risking. I could easily believe that Montfort had planted the rumours herself, whatever they were, with the goal of ambushing Vice. I tried to remember that it was Vice who had warned me about how dangerous Montfort was, and so she would be cautious. And I kept thinking about the growing alienation and anger in Eliana's journal. "You forgave me, didn't you? That's why you've come back, isn't it? In the end, you did forgive. You must have." Unending bitterness was not who Eliana was. In the end. What end? I had no answer. I managed to pay just enough attention to the session to make it sound like I was present. That was as much a victory as I could hope for that day. I was lucky that that was the best Montfort and her allies could achieve, too. No one hid their relief when the inner council adjourned. We had done little other than mark time. I felt some shame in that. It was Solus that paid a price while we were distracted by our wars and ghosts. Belzec had already returned to my service. The injuries to her flesh were not extensive, and she was mobile again on a new treaded engine. The vehicle she now drove stopped short of being a Turo, but it was much more heavily armoured than the previous car had been. She was waiting for me outside the council hall, and we headed back towards Malvale through another day of drenching downpours. The temperature was just above freezing. We were spared sleet and cursed with torrential frigid rain instead. Gutters overflowed. Flash floods roared down the narrower streets, turning the drive back through Valgast into an interminable journey. We were caught behind a convoy of transports, carrying tons of grain. The streets were barely wide enough to contain their massive, squat bodies. They belched clouds of blue exhaust and rocked back and forth over the uneven, pitted roadway. The rain came down harder. Even on the main artery of the Boulevard of Toiling Faithful, foaming water rushed past us. If our vehicle had been any lighter, it would have been washed away. We crawled towards the Cardinal Reinhardt Bridge. It was one of the older spans over the Oblivious River. It was humpbacked, and its rockcrete was porous from centuries of acidic rainfall. The transports climbed the bridge. Water from the street gathered at its base. The swollen Oblivious churned against its pillars. There was a sudden squall of rain. The world disappeared in the dirty white of the downpour. The rise of the bridge was a vague smudge. At its base, in the middle of the road, I saw a woman's silhouette. She was motionless, a black shape in the rain. "Eliana," I whispered. I could see no features, only darkness. She was absolutely still. There was nothing to say this was Eliana, except that I knew it was. I could feel the spectre staring into my heart. Belzec did not see her. I gasped, unable to cry a warning or plead forgiveness, and then the bridge began to sway. Its side-to-side rhythm was gentle, but this was rockrete, which could not be gentle. Belzec slammed on the brakes and stopped us before we reached the bridge. We watched as the movement of the rocking cradle became a catastrophe. The huge transport seemed small now on the back of the stricken beast. The pillars in the river fell with a deep, heavy groan. The span of the bridge broke into three pieces. Through the veil of rain, the fall was beautiful. A slow, graceful dying of stone. The transports plunged into the water. They were just little things. The lives inside them invisible, the screams unheard. I opened the car door. The wind blew the rain in, drenching me. "My lord," Belzec said, trying to stop me. "It's all right," I said. This was not Montfort's doing, at least not directly. This time, the event really was an accident. What the council pretended had happened to the Manufactorum now had happened to the Cardinal Reinhardt Bridge. Another collapse. Another gasp of Solus's crumbling infrastructure. The drivers of the transports and the other vehicles that had fallen into the oblivious had been murdered by the council. The funds that should have gone to restoring the bridge had lined the pockets of the councillors and their cronies instead. Now people were dying. I stood at the edge of the shattered span, looking down into the river. The transports had vanished. The wreckage of the bridge thrust up from the turmoil of the river like tombstones. There was no one to rescue, but I stayed there until the militia arrived. It was important that I be seen by the growing crowds. I wanted them to know that their Lord Governor stood by them. I didn't like thinking about the political advantage this might give me over Montfort. That was a form of pragmatism I despised. I could also not deny the truth of the situation. "Well done. You're turning into a politician." At length, I acknowledged that there was nothing I could do here, and I climbed back into the car. My clothes were soaked, I was chilled to the core, and I was going to be hours late to meet Weiss. I hoped she'd been able to wait, and that she'd found something useful. We had to bring Montfort down. Valgast could not withstand her corruption much longer. The rain was still hammering Valgast when we finally passed through Malvale's gates. I was startled to see Karoff standing outside in the cloudburst. We were about a quarter of the way up the hill. He was in the shadow of a rusted crane. He wasn't moving. I couldn't see him clearly, but I got the impression he was staring into the middle distance of nothing at all. "What is he doing?" I said.
"My lord?"
"Karoff, look." Belzec slowed the vehicle.
"I'm sorry, my lord, but where?"
He was gone. He must have gone around one of the support columns of the crane. "Never mind," I said. I would ask him what he'd been doing later. But when we arrived and I ran from the car to the entrance, Karoff was opening the door for me. He was perfectly dry. There was no way he could have made it here before us. "My lord?" he asked when I stared at him. "It's all right," I said, but my skin crawled. "Has Councillor Weiss been here long?"
"She hasn't been here at all, my lord."
"I see." Worried, I went up to my tower to change into dry clothes. There were innocuous reasons for Weiss to be delayed. She might also have been caught by the widespread chaos caused by the collapse of the Cardinal Reinhardt Bridge. Given where she'd gone, though, I conjured worst-case scenarios. So I breathed a vast sigh of relief when I descended to the ground floor and found her waiting for me in the librarium. "I didn't know you'd arrived," I said. "I'm glad to see you." She was damp from the storm, and one hand was rubbing her temple. She looked up at me.
"Oh, Mason," she said. "Yes. Yes. I wanted to see you."
"So you said." I sat down beside her. "Did you learn anything useful?" She blinked slowly. There was something wrong with her gaze. It was unfocused. She kept looking back and forth at me, and then at nothing.
"Learned," she said. "Oh, yes."
She winced. "Are you all right?" I asked. "Did something happen?" Her jaw dropped open and her head jerked down and to the side. She flailed like a hooked fish. I lunged forward to catch her and then stopped. There she was, sitting quietly, still looking confused. But that was all. I sat back. I closed my eyes, opened them. Nothing had changed.
"What's wrong with me?"
"I came here," Weiss said.
"Yes, you did."
"I have to warn you."
About what?
She stood.
Warn you,
she said again and walked unsteadily out of the librarium. Adriana, I called after her and followed. Where are you going?
I have to go.
Not now. Let me get some help for you. You're not well. She opened the door. The rain hammered with such ferocity that I couldn't see the drive beyond the porch.
I must go.
Clutching her head, she stepped out into the rain. I went after her, and a blast of wind hurled rain into my face, blinding me. I stumbled back into the cover of the entranceway, wiping the water from my eyes. I couldn't see her. Then a long, vague shadow rumbled up to the porch. I assumed it was her car, though I didn't know why it was just arriving. I heard the sound of a door opening, and Calvin Rivas ran to the doorway.
What's going on? I asked.
Are you going to look after Adriana?
You know I will, he said.
Then I guess you've heard. His voice was foggy with grief.
Heard what?
About Adriana, he said, looking confused now. They've just pulled her body from the river. She's been murdered. Chapter 12.
When?
I demanded, managing not to grab the doorway to support myself.
She was just killed now?
In my confusion and shock, I was starting to babble. No, said Rivas. She was probably killed some hours ago. She's only just been found.
But that isn't...
I began, then stopped.
But that isn't possible. She was just here.
Just like it wasn't possible for Karoff to be in two places at once. It was suddenly hard to breathe.
What's wrong? Rivas asked.
I'm not sure. I would have to tell him.
Not right now.
He would be even more insistent that I leave Malvale immediately. I couldn't. I would not.
Vice came to warn me. She was dead, and she still wanted to help.
What was going on at Malvale was not an attack.
But the slaughterhouse in Katrin's room, the shrieking revels in Xander's, that was a dream. It was.
It would take more than that for me to abandon Eliana.
She saved my life today.
I decided, then and there, how I would interpret the vision at the bridge.
There is no evil here.
Take me to Adriana, I said to Rivas, and I went to get my coat. Rivas's ecclesiarchy vehicle was solemnly ornate. Mine had the family's coat of arms and the Lord Governor's crest on the sides. It was a simple affair by comparison. Gold scrollwork lined the body of Rivas's car. The ecclesiarchal symbol on the roof seemed the size of a monument. The vehicle was not only visible, but instantly recognisable from a great distance, announcing its holy mission to all who saw it. Rivas's quiet sanctity imbued the luxury with sacredness. This was not ostentation. The glories of artisanship on display were a tribute to the God Emperor.
Are we going to Silling? I asked.
The Oblivis ran by the edge of the Montfort estate on the southern edge of Valgast.
What?
Said Rivas.
No. She was pulled from the Loth, not the Oblivis, just a few miles from here.
Nothing made sense. I said nothing for the rest of the drive. For the moment, grief was standing at bay. I believed that Vice was dead, but not at the emotional level. I'd just spoken to her minutes ago. She'd spoken to me. Her death was a thing reported, not real. Her visitation, though, that was real. I did not understand what was happening at Malvale, but I was growing more and more accepting of its reality. There were events that still had to be cordoned off as dreams, but I had not dreamt seeing Vice. I would not denigrate that miracle.
Miracles. That's what these events are. They are blessings sent by the Emperor.
The epiphany was so sudden and so obvious that I almost laughed with sudden joy. I kept still. This was not the moment. He would not understand. I thought he would, though, in time. A miracle would explain Eliana's return to me. A miracle was not heretical. Why the miracle was occurring was another question. I might leave that to Rivas to sort out. Rivas's driver took the road that ran along the northern edge of the industrial shell and the base of Malvale's hill. Past the hill, the river Loth flowed down from the north, then turned east, marking the edge of Valgast. After a few minutes, we reached a grey wasteland. The manufacturia here had been largely torn down, leaving an uneven landscape littered with mounds of tailings and rusting disassembled machinery. Though the mines were closed, the ground was still saturated with toxins. The river ran black and brown. Grey sludge foamed against the banks. The militia had erected a large tarpaulin tent by the riverside. Their vehicles surrounded it. The Toro of the Adeptus Arbites was there too. The sides of the tent flapped tautly in the wind. The sheeting rain rattled against the tarp. Rivas and I ran to the entrance. Stavark was just inside with two of his troopers. He was in full uniform and armour, the visor of his helmet hiding his eyes, shock maul sheathed at his waist. He nodded solemnly.
"Lord Governor," he said, "Cardinal, I grieve for you and for Solas. This is a great loss. We will all feel it."
At the other end of the tent was a Medicaid table. Militia officers were gathered around the shape that lay on its surface. "Is the investigation yours?" I asked Stavark, hoping that it was. He shook his head.
"Not yet," he said. "Not until I can determine a threat to the Imperium."
"But this is clearly linked to your investigation of Trefecht. This is retaliation for her arrest."
"We don't know that," said Stavark.
"What else could it be?" He glanced towards the corpse.
"I really don't know."
I advanced towards the Medicaid table, Rivas at my side. The militia officers saw us and parted. I looked down on my friend. Now her death hit home. The memory of Vice's visit earlier faded before the reality of her corpse. I placed my palms on the edge of the table, my arms locking to hold me up. I forced myself to look at her head, though the wound there reopened injuries in my soul, tearing them deeper. The wound to her head was enormous. She was almost unrecognizable, with half her skull smashed. It looked like something had gone through the top of her head, crushing the right side of her skull and piercing down through her shoulder as far as her ribcage. A few feathers remained from her headdress, matted in blood, stuck to the ruin of her skull.
"What could have done this?" said Rivas.
I had seen wounds like this before, on Clostrum. It looked like she'd been stabbed by a Tyranid's talon.
"But that cannot be. This impossibility I will not accept. But look at the wound. Other things could have done that. Identifying causes of injuries is not my field of expertise."
Clinging to the rational was hard. I was staring at the body of my best friend, and all I could think was that the devourers of Clostrum had escaped from my nightmares to kill her. Rivas clasped my shoulder. He thought he was seeing grief alone in my reaction.
"We will honour her," he said.
"And avenge her," I croaked. I turned away from the table. The emotions I'd held off on the drive were crashing down on me like massive breakers. If I did not stand up to them, I would drown. I stiffened my gait and walked over to Stavak. "What is known?" I asked him. The militia might have jurisdiction for now, but I didn't trust them.
"Not much," said Stavak. "A passing patrol spotted her washed up against the riverbank."
"How convenient," I said quietly.
"Perhaps, perhaps not. The patrols are regular. Sooner or later, she was bound to be seen, even here."
"How did she wind up here?" Rivas wondered. "Was she coming to see you?" he asked me. "Yes, but when I last saw her, she was headed for Siling. She was hoping to learn something we could use against Montfort." I spoke quietly. If Stavark saw fit to share his information with the militia, I would trust his judgment. I suspected they already knew. Rivas and Stavark looked grim.
"If she was killed there, we will find no evidence or witnesses," said Stavark.
"This would be a brazen attack, even for Montfort," Rivas said. "To my knowledge, she's never had a political rival killed before."
"To your knowledge," I pointed out, "and perhaps she's never felt the need to do so before.
Have you managed to threaten her that much?"
"I didn't think I had."
I felt no pride. I felt sorrow and anger. If I could have wrapped my hands around Montfort's throat then and there, I would have. I was furious at myself, too. I had plunged into the war in the full knowledge that my life was at risk. If I was honest, the assassination attempt had provided me with a certain dark satisfaction. I was concerned with keeping my family safe, but it was myself I imagined being the principal target. I invited Montfort's wrath. Let her call lightning upon my head. I would send it back at her 1,000-fold.
I hadn't thought that she would begin to slaughter the few on the council who dared oppose her. Vice had been a thorn in her side for decades, and no harm had come to her. Until now.
I should have seen this coming. I should have anticipated the full consequences of my campaign. Instead, I had left an ally to be cut down on the battlefield. I had been careless.
You were worse than that. You were arrogant. You were proud.
Vice was dead because of my pride. I would have time for self-recriminations later. This was not the moment for indulgences.
Is there any direct action we can take?
I asked Devak. This cannot go unpunished. She will not stop.
We don't even know if this is her doing.
It was not by her hand, but it was by her command. Who else had motive?
Montfort also had good reason not to do this, Rivas pointed out. For the same reason she could not attack you again too soon, said Stavark. She has too much to lose. One mistake and everything could come crashing down. I agree with you, Lord Governor. I don't think you've managed to threaten her enough yet for this to be a sane form of retaliation.
She isn't sane, I snapped.
So you're saying that she's untouchable? For the moment, I believe so.
The air inside the tent was too close. I threw the flap open and strode outside. The wind rammed into me. In moments, the rain was streaming from my hair and down the back of my neck. There was a car by the side of the road, a short distance away from the other vehicles. Beside it, leaning on her cane, was the grey ghoul of the senior councillor. My hands balled into fists. I marched over to her against the howl of the wind. She wore a long coat, but no head covering. Her hair was plastered against her skull. Water poured from the tubes of her breathing apparatus. She was so still, she could have been another apparition. She stared at me with cold hatred.
Take your gloating elsewhere while you still can, I said.
The murder of Councillor Vice gives me no pleasure.
Liar, I will see you burn for this.
Her eyes narrowed slightly, the hate in them growing hot.
Do not think you could frame me for your crime.
My crime?
I was so astonished that she would attempt such a gambit that I could say nothing else for a moment.
I had no good reason to kill her, she said. Councillor Vice's death does me no good.
Since when does the death of an enemy not befit you?
When that enemy is as popular as Councillor Vice. Alive, she was an opponent. Dead, she will become a symbol, as we both know very well, one that will serve your interests against mine. You will not prevail, Lord Governor. You will be found out.
This is beyond absurd.
I began to wonder if I was hallucinating the conversation.
As far as I know, she was last seen alive speaking to you.
That is your evidence?
It might be enough to interest the Inquisition.
My jaw dropped open. I stared, unable to believe that she was serious. I didn't put any stratagem or any crime past her, but she sounded utterly mad. She couldn't really believe that was a credible threat.
By all means, I said, invite the Inquisition to pay me a visit.
You are a Strock of Malvale, she said. You should be conscious of what that means.
I am, and you should be conscious of what I am willing to do.
I turned on my heel and walked away. I heard the door of her car slam. Her driver was pulling away just as Stavark and Rivas came out of the tent to look for me. Stavark squinted through the rain at the departing vehicle.
That wasn't, he began.
It was.
She dared to come here to mock us. She actually threatened to accuse me of the murder.
Don't take that threat lightly, said Rivas.
I won't.
She should take my warning seriously, too, but I hope she doesn't. Emperor, let her slip. Let me purge more than the corruption she reigns over. Let me purge her.
I will do what is necessary.
Meaning what? Stavark asked sharply.
Exactly what I said.
The wind howled around us. We were so far beyond being drenched that we barely noticed the rain anymore. My mind was filled with images of Montfort's blood. In battle, I'd rejoiced in victories. I'd been glad to burden Xenos' filth, to remove their taint from the galaxy. But I'd never taken pleasure in killing. I would enjoy killing Montfort, though. My muscles tensed in anticipation of the strain of tearing flesh. My right palm, the prosthetic with no sensation, could feel the contours of the handle of the blade, the hammer, the las pistol. I knew already the weight of the weapons I would wield. The rain against my face was the splash of the blood of the criminal. I was a coiled spring. If Montfort had returned, I would have attacked her there and then, no matter what the circumstances. Do not destroy what you are labouring to create, Rivas warned. He knew me too well, yet he was looking at me as if I'd become a stranger.
What would you have me do? She murdered Adriana. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
Rivas said nothing. His pained look was his answer,
and it was clear enough.
Think carefully about what you plan to do, Lord Governor.
Stavark spoke calmly, but his warning was unmistakable.
I want you to succeed. Solas needs you, and it needs you more than ever now. Do not force me to take action against you.
You would do that?
I always do my duty.
Yet you say you can do nothing against Montfort.
At this moment, no, I can't. Let me repeat. We do not know that she was responsible. If I learned that she was, and her actions are destabilizing Solas, then, as with Councillor Trefect, the situation is different. But if you kill her, then you become the destabilizing force. I can see your wrath, Lord Governor. There would be no subterfuge in your attack. You would gun her down in the Council Hall if that was where you had her in your sights. And you would risk plunging Solas into civil war. I will not allow that.
Then do your duty, I snarled. I had no authority over the Adeptus Arbites, but I shouted commands as if I did. Find the evidence of her guilt. I stalked away. Mason, the Cardinal called. I didn't stop. I was seething. At least let my driver take you back. I'll walk, I shouted and kept going. I raged at Stavark's caution, even though the rational part of me, struggling to make itself heard past a roar of anger and sorrow, knew that he was right. I walked through the storm. Wind and rain lashed my face so hard I thought I might bleed. The world around me was a smear of vague silhouettes and endless grey. Reality had faded until it was nothing but ghosts. Nothing mattered, I thought. Everything would be washed away. Only my anger was strong. A flame that could not be doused. A fever that must burn until it consumed me or destroyed Montfort. I was chilled and exhausted when I reached Malvale. Katrin and Xander had heard about Vice. I did not want their condolences. I wanted revenge. I wanted justice. I needed to speak with someone who understood and believed everything that I was experiencing at Marvale. Rivas believed, but did not understand. No one else believed. Eliana. I need to speak with Eliana. I thought this as if we'd spoken outside my dreams. I felt sure that soon we would. That was surely where things were heading. This is what I told myself when I retired to my tower, cutting myself off from the rest of the house for the night. This was the one light of hope I reached for in the midst of the roiling thoughts of vengeance. The storm had followed me into my sleep, shrieking through my mind, turning my blood cold, then hot, then cold again. I thrashed in the bed, blown back and forth by the whistling shriek of the wind outside as it tried to pry its way through clinks in the rockcrete walls. When I woke, I was tangled in sweat-soaked sheets. My skin was burning. My tongue felt thick and dry. I sat up, and my head swam. The fever raged through my blood, and I was a furnace. Yet the fever was not just in me. Heat radiated from the walls. I lit the lumen globe and stared blearily around me. The room pulsed in time with my heart. I reached out and placed my palm against the nearest wall. In the next instant, I snatched my hand away. The surface felt like taut skin, trembling with disease. It was damp, too, with a thick, jellied sweat. I heard vomiting. The sound was huge, as if the house itself were being ill. The hallways turned throats, expelling the liquefied accumulations into the unused rooms. It also sounded personal, as of a single individual in the grip of a ferocious disease, throwing up with such violence that their body was turning inside out. The retching and thick splashes turned my stomach. I breathed through my mouth to combat the nausea and staggered up. I weaved back and forth, dizzy, as I made my way to the door. Once again, I was being summoned. There were revelations at hand. I must attend to them. An urgency of action drove me forward, though I did not know what I was being called upon to do, nor did I know who was calling. Eliana! I cried as I fumbled with the door. She did not answer. The heat was suffocating. It came in pulsing waves, squeezing my head and stomach. I could barely stand. When I finally got the door opened, the buzzing of a swarm of flies roared into my face. I choked, clapped one hand over my mouth and nose and waved the other frantically. I squinted to keep the insects out of my eyes, even though I could not see them. The light was dim and the air squirmed, so thick that breathing felt like inhaling insect eggs. I stumbled down the stairs, bumping against walls that had become heaving flesh. Their sweat pooled on the staircase, making footing treacherous. I reached the first floor hall, desperate for its greater space, desperate to breathe something clean.
The air was even worse. It stank of rot and loosed bowels. The buzz of flies was deafening. I beat at nothing, frantic and repulsed. The vomiting sound became a retching scream, followed by panic choking, and then the liquid scream again. Behind the bedroom doors, my children were calling for me. Their young voices were high with terror. This was what I'd been summoned to do. I must get them out while there was still time, before we were consumed by the sickness that had seized Marvale. Katrin was desperately trying to be brave, but her voice was trembling, and Xander's little cries were frantic with incomprehension and fear. I called back to them. I almost vomited as I shouted, an acid burn scraped my throat. I tried Katrin's door, and then Xander's. The handles were coated in slime. Pustules burst under my grip, releasing centipedes that curled around my fingers, swelling my joints with their venomous bites. I lost my grip and hammered helplessly against the door that held Xander prisoner.
Father!
Katrin's voice, nearby. Xander echoed her. Their cries came from my right, not from their bedrooms at all. At the same moment, I smelled smoke. I saw them at the head of the stairs. Xander had his arms wrapped tightly around his big sister, his face buried against her waist. Katrin was pointing down the stairs.
He's setting the house on fire!
She shouted. I ran to the stairs and caught a glimpse of a figure charging through the hall with a flaming torch. The smoke was getting thick, and the heat of the fire added itself to the heat of fever. I was about to pick Katrin and Xander up and carry them down, but if the man below attacked, I'd be unable to fend him off. I could barely stand as it was.
"Take Xander's hand," I said to Katrin. "Hold tight. Follow me carefully. If I tell you to wait, you wait. If I tell you to run, run for the door as fast as you possibly can."
She nodded. She was pale, though her cheeks were flushed. The sickness had her in its grasp too, but she was being strong. I started down the stairs as quickly as I could. The vomiting sound, I now thought, was the house reacting to the murderous intruder, seeking to hurl him out, even as he wounded it with fire. This was Montfort's doing. She was attacking to end us all, me, the children, and the house. Rage gave me strength, though I slipped on the sweat and crawling vermin on the steps. The banister squirmed in my grip, pliable as muscle, porous as sponge. My lungs rattled with larvae. I could barely move through the smoky air, as thick as quicksand, yet I made it to the ground floor. The torch-bearing figure burst out of the librarium, flames high and bright behind him. He was a blurred silhouette. I couldn't see his face. He ran for the main doors, and I followed. I had to stop him. If I didn't, I knew what he would do once he crossed the threshold. He would shut the doors and seal them, trapping us in the conflagration.
Run!
I shouted. I could not look to see if the children obeyed. All my concentration was focused on staying upright and catching the intruder. He stayed ahead of me, reaching the entrance and hurled the doors back. The storm was still strong. The wind and rain roared into the hall. I ran into the blast after the intruder. He disappeared into the darkness, and I stopped running when I reached the drive. The explosion threw me to the ground. My children's screams fell into its roar. A wave of fire washed over me, the pain a burning lance on my back. Helpless, I howled. The thunder of the explosion faded, and I vomited, retching until only a thin string of bile-dark drool dripped from my lips. I pushed myself up. Smoke and dust stung my nostrils, another howl building in my chest. I turned around to face the destruction and the bodies of my children. The house was intact. It was quiet. There were no bodies. There was no smoke, no roar of flame. Yet my ears were still ringing from the blast. My back was hot from the burn.
You should be past questions. Accept this and learn what it might mean.
I went back inside. The floor was wet from the rain, but there was no slime anywhere. The heat of the fever was gone. I pushed the doors closed, locked them, and cautiously headed back to the first floor.
Purged. The house is purged. It warned me of the intruder, and I chased him out, saving the house and the children.
But the flames.
What he would have done, we stopped him.
My head was clear. My legs steady again. I could breathe easily. The stench had evaporated. There was no trace of the illness or of my young ones. I started to call for them, but the silence of the halls and a sudden suspicion stopped me. They've gone back to their rooms. The danger has passed. They saw you had saved them, and they've gone to bed.
Oh, have they now?
On the first floor, I tried Xander's door.
The handle was dry. The door opened easily, and I padded inside. My eyes had adjusted to the dark, and I could just discern the adult Xander under the bedcovers. He was sleeping.
Or so he wants you to think.
I stood beside the bed for a full minute, motionless, waiting for him to think I was gone and betray himself. He didn't move, his breathing deep and steady. I left him and tried Katrin's room. She too gave every appearance of being asleep. Her discipline was stronger than Xander's. If she broke, though, he would give himself away immediately. So I stayed there for a long time, in the dark, absolutely still, hands clenched in anger at the deception.
Who are you? What have you done with my children? Does Montfort have them?
If they had harmed Katrin and Xander, there would be no mercy. I blinked, suddenly unsure why I was there. This was Katrin. What was I doing? What was I thinking? I crept out of the room and shut the door. I returned to my chamber, jaw set and grim. I was still a bit disorientated. My grip on time and the passage of years was uncertain. At the same time, I knew I'd not been dreaming. I was receiving messages. I was being shown things. There were truths that I needed to unearth. I felt better when I was back in the tower with the door bolted.
Can we trust those people sleeping below?
I was not sure that I could. Chapter 13. My husband is an honourable man. His uncle was an honourable man. So much honour in the Strock family. Generations and generations and generations of honour and duty and faith and unquestioning service to the Imperium, such loyalty to the Emperor, an exemplary family, centuries of labour to create a legacy of honour. I know what honour smells like. I know its stench. I know its foundation, what lies below. All these legacies are a mere film. All these centuries of duty, what are they worth? A film so thin, always ready to tear. I understand the labour in this house now too. The relics of the past, trying to bury the foundations. You are such an honourable man, Mason. What do you think? Is it duty to the end? Duty to preserve? Duty to save? Is that what you think? Do you think the end isn't already here? Do you think everything isn't already rotting, already rotten? So many chains. We are bound. I am shackled. Once we see and feel the chains, it is too late. That is a lie too, a comforting one. The truth is that it is always too late. The chains are always there. When was it too late for me? When I crossed the threshold for the first time? When I saw Malvale for the first time? The chains are long. The chains go deep. The chains were always there. There is no freedom, only chains. Never day, ever night. I left the house again. Isn't that something? Are you proud of me, Mason? Answer me! Don't be proud. I'm not. It felt like an accomplishment. It wasn't. I didn't pull myself free. I wasn't even released. I was hauled along by the chains. I discovered nothing. I was made to see. Sometimes Malvale rattles the chains for its amusement, for its joke. I would like to tell you something, Mason. I would like to tell you many things. But here is a small secret. It's a secret about humour and fate. You know what it is? I have to make my writing as small as possible so I can whisper. Fate and humour are the same thing, and that is terrible. Consider the nature of jokes, Mason. The construction of a joke is the movement toward a surprise that is also inevitable. When the ending arrives, we see, despite and because of the absurdity, that no other ending was ever possible. It was fated. The Strocks are fated, Mason. I am too. The chains are strong. If you ever see them, you will try to break them. You will fail. The chains begin with Devris Strock. Lionel discovered this too late. So did all his predecessors. So did I. Devris made the pact. Lionel saw the proof. I have not yet. I know I will. The time is coming soon when I will have to look below. I have been to the Administratum for one last time. That was where Malvale sent me. That was where the chains dragged me. I knew where to look. The name of Devris was on enough fragments. The past is buried in Malvale, but it is restless. It surfaces. It sends up the lures, and then the iron traps snap shut. So, I have seen what I was meant to see, and I have been brought back. I do not think I will ever leave Malvale again. If I have seen this, Mason, you should too. Why should I be the only one of us to bear this curse? You fight the wars and you are shielded. You cannot know. You abandoned me and you labour for duty and honour. You are honourable to your core. Honour is thin. It is brittle. It is your truth, but it is a lie. It is just the weakest film stretched over the pact. I will throw away the past too. There is nothing else I can do. It serves no purpose. Nothing does. Maybe I will gain time. Maybe that doesn't matter. Honour. I wish the word were flesh. I would rip it with my teeth. I would drink its rotten blood. The storm had finally ended. The sky was still a heavy grey, gathering its strength for another burst. Rain fell intermittently, and the wind keened, cold as scalpel cut against the flesh. I welcomed the bracing pain as I walked the grounds of Malvale in the desultory morning. I needed the air. Eliana's journal was becoming harder and harder to read. I could no longer take any pleasure from it. I dreaded the effort. The hatred, the despair and the anger that soaked the pages were beyond disturbing. I had known that the closer I came to the final pages, the more upsetting I would find her words. Things could hardly be otherwise, with her suicide waiting after the last page. But I had not counted on the specific nature of her distress. The exhaustion she'd complained about before seemed to have turned into a belief that Malvale held her prisoner. Is that true, or was it something within her that formed a delusion? I did not understand everything that was happening at Malvale. There were aspects that were frightening. I did not think they were dangerous. I could come and go as I liked. I was not a prisoner. I did not want to leave, but that was not the same thing as being held. I wish that I could have done something for her while she was alive. I wished that I could have helped her find joy in Malvale. Maybe I can make a difference. Maybe I can give her peace now. She's reaching out to me. I will not abandon her again. So I kept telling myself. I clung to that hope tenaciously. I needed it to give me the strength to get through the rest of the journal. That was going to take some time. It was not just the content that was difficult. Page by page, Eliana's handwriting slowly degraded. It became cramped, so jagged and angular that I could barely recognize it as hers. It had become infinitesimally small. It took several minutes to decipher each line, and the eye strain gave me a headache before I'd managed to read more than half a page. Worse yet, actual words only make up a small portion of each line. It was as if Eliana were trying to hide her thoughts within a forest of incomprehensible marks. The stylus scratches looked like letters, and they were clustered into groups resembling words. There were even patterns in the shapes. Sometimes, my eyes watering, my head pounding, I found myself trying to decipher the shapes and feeling on the verge of comprehension. In such moments, I jerked myself away from the journal and had to leave it alone for a time. It became distasteful to me when that happened. It became a thing I did not want to touch. Eliana hinted at things I did not want to know, but could not ignore. So far, she was vague about what she might have found at Malvale itself. But she'd gone to the Administratum Palace, and there was a name. Devris Strock. I followed the path she'd set for me. I had Belzec take me to the palace. It dominated the eastern sector of Valgast, a gigantic complex of black ferrocrete. Spires surmounted the great dark hulk, the largest building on Solus. It was keeper of records, keeper of memories, keeper of secrets, and monster of regulations. It sprawled for miles on each side and was higher than any other structure in Valgast, except for the towers of the cathedral. The entrance hall was sombre, lit by candelabra. Its walls slanted inwards, meeting at a point more than 70 feet above. Though the floor was wide, the hall felt narrow. Its lines drew the gaze up. Suspended from the apex was the huge Administratum symbol, the great imperial eye with the embedded coiled rune of the Adeptus. The dimness and the solemnity of the space commanded silence. A few robed scribes passed as I entered. A servo skull flew up to me. "Archives," I said. "Reference, Curator Strock, Eliana." The servo skull chattered in Binharic and then retreated, flying through an aperture in the far wall behind a high iron pulpit raised 10 feet above the floor. Doors opened a moment later, and a scribe in dark robes strode to the pulpit and looked down at me.
"Lord Governor," she said, "you are welcome. You seek records related to your honoured wife."
"Yes, specifically one she would have requested herself the last time she was here." The scribe typed a query into the cogitator mounted onto the pulpit. She consulted the screen, then flipped through the pages of a massive tome on the lectern before her.
"These are ancient records indeed," she said. Approvingly, I thought. "It will take some time to reach them."
She pulled a brass lever in the pulpit, and another set of doors behind her opened. The servo skull flew back out of its aperture, and through the doors came a wheeled servitor.
"Historical," the scribe said to the skull. "Vault Secundus, sublevel 12, archive 127.
The servo skull spat out a thin scroll, which the scribe tore off and inserted into the back of the quiescent servitor's neck. The servitor jerked into motion.
"You will be taken to the records," said the scribe.
I thanked her, and followed the servitor through an archway on the east side of the hall. For more than 20 minutes, we walked through vaulted corridors, going deeper and deeper into the maze of the Administratum Palace. We passed honeycombs of cells where scribes laboured over transcriptions and exegetical texts, reconciling conflicting regulations. We crossed narrow bridges, barely 3 feet wide, that cut across the immense spaces of the enormous vaults. In Vault Secundus, the servitor led me down the webwork of bridges to a sublevel that must have been more than 100 feet below the surface. The servitor approached one of the archives and moved onto a lift platform at its base. Mechanisms engaged, and the platform carried the servitor up a rail on the high iron archive. The lighting was dim here too, and the servitor became indistinct as it neared the top of the archive. I heard the grind of a cabinet door opening, and after a minute, the servitor descended, laden with documents. I followed at another short distance to a reading cell. The servitor deposited the records on an iron table that took up most of the space in the cell, then departed. I sat on a dark oaken stool and looked through the documents. They were, as the scribe had said, very old. Vellum sheets cracked, brittle with age. Parchment crumbled at my touch. The printing was faded and sometimes illegible. History was vanishing slowly into the void of the past. The files were a miscellany of everything that had passed through the Administratum during a period centuries back, a time that I recognised as coinciding with the rise of the Strox to power. There were hundreds of records, and I spent hours combing through minor regulatory adjustments, notices of punishments meted out to families I'd never heard of, agricultural production reports, and on, an endless collection of bureaucratic trivia. But at last I found one of the documents that Eliana must have been referring to. It was a duplicate of the exploitation license granted to Devris Strock for the mineral resources discovered in the Malvale grounds. I found another report, dated several months later, that summarised the special session of the council following the death of Lord Governor Agatha Montfort. Instead of her son, Gregor, succeeding her, the council had named Devris to the position. The report was a dry summary, a record that existed merely to exist, with little expectation that it would ever be read. But it marked the moment of my family's ascendance. Devris was the first Lord Governor Strock. I had never known his name. The accomplishment was remembered. The man was utterly forgotten. The oblivion that surrounded my predecessors deepened. The paradox of power and obscurity that held the Strocks was more than strange. But there was nothing really new here. I had confirmation